So today we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 23, entitled Maharaj Prithu's Going Back Home. Text 6. Please repeat after me. Grishme pancho tapaviro.
Grishme pancho tapaviro.
Grishme pancho tapaviro.
Grishme pancho tapaviro.
Varshas. Vasarashan Muni Varshas Vasarashan
Muni
Akantha Magna Shishire Udaki Sthandileshayah Udaki Tandileshayaha Grishme in the summer season. Panchatapa, five kinds of heating. Viraha, the hero. Varashasu, in the rainy season. Asharashat,
being situated
within the torrents of rain. Munihi, like the great sages. Akanta, up to the neck. Magna, drowned. Shishire, in the winter. Udake, within water. Standile shayaha, lying down on the floor. Translation purport by Zvangris A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki. Translation. Following the principles of forest living and the footsteps of the great sages and munis, Prithu Maharaj accepted five kinds of heating processes during the summer season, exposed himself to torrents of rain in the rainy season, and in the winter stood in water up to his neck. He also used to simply lie down on the floor to sleep. Please repeat. Following the principles of forest living.
Following the principles of forest living.
And the footsteps of the great sages and munis.
And the footsteps of great sages and munis.
Prithu Maharaj accepted five kinds of heating processes.
Prithu Maharaj accepted five kinds of heating processes.
During the summer season.
During the summer season.
Exposed himself to torrents of rain in the rainy season. And in the winter, stood in water up to his neck. He also used to simply lie down on the floor to sleep. Purport. These are some of the austerities executed by the jnanis and yogis who cannot accept the process of bhakti yoga. They must undergo such severe types of austerity in order to become purified from material contamination. Panchatapaha refers to five kinds of heating processes. One is enjoined to sit within a circle of fire with flames blazing from four sides and the sun blazing directly overhead. This is one kind of panchatapaha recommended for austerity. Similarly, in the rainy season, one is enjoined to expose himself to torrents of rain and in the winter to sit in cold water up to the neck. As far as bedding is concerned, the ascetic should be content with simply lying on the floor. The purpose for undergoing such severe austerities is to become a devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, as explained in the next verse. Om Gyanam Timranthasya Gyananjana Shilakaya Chakshurur Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Mano Bhishnam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Svapadantikam. Following the principles of forest living and the footsteps of the great sages and munis, Prithu Maharaj accepted five kinds of heating processes during the summer season, exposed himself to torrents of rain in the rainy season, and in the winter stood in water up to his neck. He also used to simply lie down on the floor to sleep. So this text is describing Prithu Maharaj's austerities. After he became a king, then after he had finished ruling the kingdom, he took to great severe austerities, and he gave up everything with complete detachment. So this actually is an interesting point, that someone who's used to such luxury, you know, the kings, they're always surrounded by servants, they've got soft beds and wonderful clothes. After that, they just give it all up and they go to the forest and they perform austerities. And we find a similar example in the story of Lord Ramachandra, where many people, they criticize Lord Ram after fighting with Lord Rama, with Ravana, and when he returned to Ayodhya, then he ruled the kingdom for 100,000 years. And after that, due to some gossip in among a few of the civilians about Mother Sita's chastity, Lord Ramachandra just gave her up. He left her in the forest in the sage's hermitage, and simply just due to a little bit of criticism. Even though in some ways it was immoral to do that, because he knew and she knew that she had never been unchaste. She was perfectly chaste. And the citizens, their complaints were basically false complaints. You know, they didn't have any justified reason to say that, because after conquering Ravana, after going through this whole forest experience, then in order to prove Sita Devi's chastity, he had her walk through fire, right? He had her do the Agni Pariksha. And so many people were witness at that time. All the monkeys were witness at that time. Of course, the citizens, that's what they were jeering about, was, oh, only the monkeys watched it. Who depends on monkeys? And then the other, you know, kings there, whoever was present there, Vibhishan, all these people, they all saw this test taking place. And Mother Sita had actually passed this test. But the reason why Lord Ramachandra did this was to show his level of detachment, you could say. First of all, to show what an ideal king is, but also to show that how internally he was so detached. Because someone could criticize that for his own wife, for just his wife, he sacrificed the lives of so many monkeys and so many soldiers, right? He fought this great battle of Lord with Ravana. And someone could say, simply for a selfish reason, that he wanted to get his wife back. You know, that's it. He gave so much pain to millions of living entities simply for the purpose of his wife, to get his wife back. You know, after all, Ravana was a great king. He was ruling his kingdom very perfectly. I mean, everything in his kingdom was made out of gold, and his citizens were very happy. But then to show that actually, no, he was doing this for religious principles, because this was the path of dharma. When the time came to leave his wife, he immediately gave it up. He didn't even think twice. He could immediately renounce that attachment. So it wasn't sort of, you could say, he was showing that how, even though he was ruling the entire kingdom, and he fought this battle and all these things, but he was not doing it for himself. He was, when the time came, he fought for Mother Sita, but when the opposite situation came, he became immediately unattached. So in the same way, we see the lives of Maharaj Prithu and Bharat Maharaj, for example, that when the time came to give up the kingdom and perform austerities, they left everything as though it was simply trash, it says in the Bhagavad Gita, as simply just useless items, and went to the forest and performed great austerities. And as we see here, they performed very, very severe austerities, extremely severe austerities. So, the austerities that are described here are quite excruciating, as you can see. Generally, people have heating during the winter and cooling during the summer. But here, we find that he's having heating during the summer season and cooling during the winter season. So, most of these austerities that we see, they're not even possible for us in this day and age, right? Especially for those of us who have grown up in the city, we have heating systems, right, that always keep the temperature at 70 degrees Fahrenheit. So like myself, if I go out in the cold for long enough, for without heating or something like that, then I just fall sick. So some of these are not even practical. So are these recommended? Naturally, the question comes: Are these immense austerities, intense austerities, are they to be performed? Are they recommended in the scriptures? So Srila Prabhupada, in the first line of the purport, he answers this. He says that these austerities are executed by the jnanis and yogis who cannot accept the process of bhakti yoga. So the question is, why is he saying this? Why is he saying that the bhakti yogi, the devotee of the Lord, does not have to execute these austerities? Why only the jnanis and the yogis have to perform this?
They obtain the same result.
They obtain the same result, okay. So the bhakti yogi attains the same result as the jnanis, but that's exactly our question, is why do they attain the same result? Why don't the bhakti yogis have to perform?
Because they have no bhakti.
They have no bhakti?
No, yes. The opposite, sorry, the yogis. Yes. The jnanis have no bhakti.
The jnanis have no bhakti, yes. So the reason is because the goal of all these austerities is to come to Krishna, to have love for Krishna. So the devotee who's come in devotion to Krishna has already attained the goal of all these austerities. So there's no necessity for him to perform these intense austerities. Prabhupada, actually, in the next few purports, he talks about this. He says that the goal of all these different austerities is to come to the process of bhakti yoga, about chanting and hearing and glorifying and serving the Lord. And one who's come to that platform, he's already attained that goal. So he has no reason to perform any of these austerities. He has no reason to perform any austerities whatsoever. Because the goal has been attained. Right? I mean, the pure devotees of the Lord, like Mother Yashoda and all these great devotees of the Lord, they're not performing any austerities per se. They're just loving Krishna. Because they've attained the goal of those austerities. There's no necessity for them to perform these. Now, but the devotee does perform austerities, right? Those of us on the path, on the process of bhakti yoga, we perform austerities. So what austerities do we perform? What are our austerities that we perform in devotional service?
Get up in the morning.
Yes. Getting up in the morning.
We serve the devotee.
Serve the devotees, yes. So we perform the austerities, only the austerities that are necessary for execution of devotional service, right? So Mother Yashoda, she's also performing austerities. It's described in the pastime of the Damodar Leela that when she's churning the butter, Krishna's churning the milk to get the butter, then she's sweating and perspiring. And she's working very hard, especially mentions that she's laboring very hard. And this is one point that Srila Prabhupada makes, that for Krishna we have to labor very hard, following the footsteps of the devotees like Mother Yashoda. So that she's laboring so hard, but she's laboring only what is necessary in the execution of devotional service. Not otherwise. There's no purpose for austerities, simply to, you could say, to perform austerities for the sake of austerities. One's performing the austerities of devotional service to gain the favor of the Lord, for no other reason than that. It describes that in the, I think, fourth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, that the denizens of Vaikuntha are engaged in cleaning the floors of the palaces. Even though in Vaikuntha there's no dust, right? There's no dust there. So why are they cleaning the floors? It never gets dirty. It says they're cleaning the floors simply to attract the mercy of Krishna. So if they're cleaning the floors and Krishna happens to pass by, he'll notice and he'll become pleased. And so by that way they'll get blessings. So they perform austerities for pleasing Krishna. So these five types of sacrifices, these pancha tapa, five types of heating processes and different types of sacrifices, they are good to a certain level in the sense that they are for those who want to advance in their spiritual life. But at a certain point, they may actually become a disturbance, right? If we're sitting in the middle of the desert with five fires around ourselves, it's difficult to perform devotional service to Krishna. Our devotional service is doing what Krishna wants us to do, you know, pleasing the Lord. So the example, of course, the famous analogy that Srila Prabhupada gives in this regard is the method of the cat or the monkey, right? The monkey tries to hold on to the mother, to the mother monkey. How? By climbing on the back of the mother, right? He's this little, you know, tiny little monkey with not much strength. And his mother is carrying him from place to place and is jumping from tree to tree, from branch to branch. And he's holding on for his dear life. You know, once in a while they actually fall off. You see that in Vrindavan. They actually, when the mother is jumping very hard, then they'll sometimes slip off and fall on the ground. And so that's the method of the jnanis and the yogis, that through their own effort, through their own endeavor, they're trying to attain the Lord through as much, you know, strength and power that what they can use. But another method is of the devotees, which is that of the kitten, where when the kitten needs to be moved by his mother or go with his mother, then the kitten doesn't try to hold on to the mother, cat, but the cat holds the kitten within her teeth, like this, holds her up. And then that kitten feels very secure, it's completely safe, you know, no difficulties. He or she is under the shelter of the mother. And because the strength of the cat is greater than that of the child, the strength of the mother is greater than that of the child, the little kitten is more secure than the little monkey, right? The little kitten is far more secure than the monkey, because that little kitten is relying on the power of the mother, or the devotee is relying on the power of the Lord for his protection and for his advancement, rather than his own power, his own strength. Now, so, but this is not to say that austerities should not be performed, right? This is not to make us lenient in austerities. We read in the 7th canto in Srimad Bhagavatam that Rishabhdev, he points this out. He says that human life is meant for austerities, right? He says, Tapo divyam yena kaputram brahma sokhyam vanantam. That he says, one should not pursue the happinesses and distresses of this world, right? The enjoyments of this world are the very same as those found in the animal species of life. Nayam deha deho bhajan riloke kashtana kaman arati vitujana. That even in the animals we find these different types of enjoyments. And endeavor, so austerity must be performed, right? They say no pain, no gain, right? So austerity must be taken. But if austerity is taken for the purpose of temporary material pursuits, then those pleasures that we derive from as a result of those austerities, those are found in the animal species as well, right? Those pleasures exist there as well. But he says austerity should be performed for the Supreme Lord. Why? Because that leads to Brahma Sokhyam Anantam, unlimited eternal spiritual happiness. If one performs austerities for the Supreme Lord, even a little austerities, then that those austerities, they go to our lifetime benefit. Those actually benefit the soul eternally. So that's the first realization of spiritual life. That's so you could say spiritual life begins when we realize the existence of time, right? That everything in this world is temporary. That's like many times if people wonder what's the basis of philosophy, right? What's the fundamental question of all of philosophy? What's the inspiration, or you could say the motivation behind philosophy? Why does philosophy exist? Someone have a suggestion? I mean, we could just do away with the whole field, but why did it begin with or start with? Jai Shri Shri Radha Gopinath ki jai. It begins with the realization of time, right? Time. Every single, even material philosopher that you see, the reason why they study their philosophy, or they started studying their philosophy, is when they realized, when the realization hit them that, oh, time exists. You know, everything is flickering. Everything is temporary. That was sort of the inspiration, you could say, the thought behind their studies, why they started studying that, with the realization of time. So time is the is our fundamental problem. It's a fundamental problem of human existence. If we didn't have time, right, then most of our frustrations would all go away, right? We become frustrated because we know we have limited amount of time. So if someone wastes our time, right, we feel angry, right? Why? Because we know that time won't come back. If we fail a class, right, we feel distressed. Why? Because we know that time is now lost. If we had unlimited time and no end, you know, no ending point, and just time went on, then there would be no cause for anxiety. Because we knew, well, if I didn't do it now, I can just do it later. There's unlimited time. But we feel anger and we feel frustration due to the existence of time. Because we know it's limited, we lost something. Right? We lost that particular time. And in the spiritual world, the difference is that we don't lose any time. No moment is lost. Right? Just like a nice example that you can think about, a way to understand this, is that just like when we come in this room, right? We're right now in this room. And then when we leave this room, we go into a different space. Right? We go from this space to that space. But just because we leave this space doesn't mean that this space ceases to exist. Right? It's like you can imagine a world where we're walking and behind us the whole world crumbles as we walk. You know, that space ceases to exist as we go to another space. No, it continues to exist. So when we come back, we can always come back to this space. We can always come back to this location. But in the nature of time, it's different. As time passes, whatever time has passed, we lose that. It's gone forever. It's completely lost. But in the spiritual world, of course, we can't conceive of these things, but we can understand that that time is never lost. So just like space in this world, we can always go back to that time. We can always, this is why when we, Prabhupada said, when we read these stories, right, when the pure devotee, when they read the pastimes of the Lord, they can actually enter into those pastimes. They can actually conceive those pastimes. Because that moment is never lost. That time is never lost. They're simply, entering into that moment. So all of Krishna's pastimes, all of the time in the spiritual world is never lost. But the time in this world is lost. Anything that we do, no matter how valuable, how significant, after a while it's gone, it's completely finished, it's lost. So Rishabdev's point is that austerities, if they're performed for something flickering, then those austerities will be lost. The benefits of those austerities will be gone very quickly. But if they're performed for the Lord, if they're performed for Krishna, then it stays on forever. It's never ending. It continues to exist. And that goes to our eternal benefit. That's never lost. That service that we do, that happiness that we derive from that austerity is never lost. Another example that the acharyas give, that Srila Prabhupada also gives, is of our situation in this material world is like that of a dream, right? In a dream, when we're dreaming at night, right, then we're completely convinced that we're there, right? It's completely vivid. There's no doubt in our mind at that point that we're not actually there in that dream world that we're seeing, right? But while we're there, we take it very seriously. But when we wake up, then we realize that our actually didn't exist. You know, it's sort of like it existed for some time, but it actually has no value. So just like in this world, we're completely convinced that we're here. Similarly, in the dream world, we're also completely convinced that we are there. Now the question is that if while we're in a dream, we're completely convinced that we're there, and when while we're awake, we're convinced that we're here, then how do we know that which is reality, right? When we were in a dream, we were actually awake, and now we're actually dreaming, or actually now that we're awake, when we dream, then we were actually dreaming, right? There's like one Buddhist philosopher, he asked this question. He, when he was, his name was something like Zhang Su, something like that. And when he was at night, he said he dreamt that he was a butterfly flying around, you know, smelling different flowers. And so he had this very vivid dream. And then when he woke up, then he realized that he was a monk, a Buddhist monk. So then he began running around the monastery, asking the question from all of his monks, that am I a butterfly dreaming that I'm a monk, or am I a monk dreaming that I'm a butterfly? So how would you convince him that he's actually a monk dreaming that he's a butterfly? Or else wakes up as a monk, right? So there's some continuity there, right? But I mean, that by itself, one couldn't be sure about, right? One could say, well, you're just having the same dream over and over again. Right? Sometimes you have continuous dreams, and you see, you're like, okay, so even that is answered, right? But how could you convince yourself that right now you're not dreaming? Right? Just like in my dreams, sometimes I've seen that I'm dreaming. Right? Sometimes you experience while you're dreaming at night, you're dreaming that you're dreaming, that you're sleeping and you're dreaming. Right? So how is it possible to know that right now we're not dreaming? Right? And the dreams that you see are just a dream within a dream. Is there any way to prove that or show that? Anyone have a suggestion?
Jump out of a tree and try.
Well, see, when we're dreaming, right, then we actually, we're in real terror, right? We're actually, the experience is very real. We're sweating, we're screaming, we're shouting. Of course, someone who's next to us, they're saying, "Hi, you know, this guy, he's you know, comfortably lying on his bed. You know, nothing's happening to him, no one's chasing him, but still he's screaming." But we have a real experience, that's why we're screaming in the dream, right? We're seeing that we're falling off a tree, that's why we're screaming. The same thing, even if you jump off a tree, it still wouldn't show that you're not dreaming. You still could be dreaming right now. Well, the scriptures actually say that yes, this is actually a dream. Just like that at night is a 60-second dream, right? It lasts for 60 seconds. Similarly, this world is a 60-year dream. It's just the duration has been elongated. This world is, you know, of the same nature as the dream. Now, why is it? Why do they describe that? Why do they liken it, this world as a dream to our dream experience? Because both have the nature of temporality, right? Why is it that when we wake up at night, after in the morning, after a good night's sleep, when we wake up and we see this horrible dream, why is it that once we wake up, we're not concerned about it anymore? We don't, you know, worry about it or fret about it anymore. Because we know that this thing won't come back to us, right? This thing, it'll never sort of touch us again. It came, it was there for some time, and now it's lost. We'll never see it again. Right? It's gone. Right? It actually has no lasting or permanent effect. Because the experiences that we had were real. The pain that we felt was real, just like we felt in this world. Right? It was still something that affected us. So we should be concerned about it. But we're not concerned about it because we know that it has no permanence. It has no lasting effect on us. In the same way, given that this is just a 70-year dream, we know, the scriptures say, that any of these experiences that we go through, any of these people who are chasing us in this world, who are fearful of, or all these things, they have no lasting effect on us. Ultimately, they don't affect the soul. After 70 years, once the body is given up, it's gone. That body and that experience, that situation has completely been lost. So therefore, there's nothing to be concerned about. So there's one Spanish poet, Calderon, and he was actually a Christian, and he also compared life to a dream. Right? We find this in every tradition. And actually it comes from the oldest source of this comparison, of comparing life to a dream, or calling it a dream, comes from the scriptures, from the Vedas. But many people have taken it and sort of imbibed it like that. So this poet, he says that if life is a dream, right, which it is, he's saying life is like a dream. He says, any gain in this world, how valuable is it? Right? Just like in a dream, you may see beautiful palaces, right? And you're a great prince in this palace, and you're walking down with horses and bullock carts and all these things. And carriages, that's what I meant. And how valuable is it, right? What's the value? Who cares for it? Once you wake up, it's gone. And then he says, and any loss in this world, how significant is it? Right? So even the gain part we may understand. Okay, if I gain anything in this world, it's temporary, it's gone, it's okay. But the losses, when we lose something, we tend to lament a lot in this world, right? That I lost something. I had something so valuable, something like that, and I lost it. He says how significant it is. Just like in a dream, if you have this great palace and then you lose it, well, what's the big deal? It's a dream. It's going to be over anyway. It's completely gone anyway. So in this material world, this duration of 70 life is a very involved dream, right? We study in the dream, we get married in the dream, we have kids in the dream, we get old in the dream, but it's all just a temporary dream. This is their point that they're saying here. So therefore, why endeavor so hard for things that will be lost anyway, right? Why make endeavor towards that extent? That's the point, that's the conclusion. They're trying to make this point. That better to endeavor for something that will actually be lasting, it will be permanent, and will stay with the soul, it will actually stick with the soul. And that is performing austerities for the benefit, for the service of the Supreme Lord. Right? Prahlad Maharaj, he says that no one in this world asks for distress, right? No one asks for unhappiness, misery, but they still come on their own accord. No one asks for misery, but it comes anyway. So just like misery comes on its own accord, he says that happiness will also come on its own accord. Just like no one asks for distress and it still comes, similarly, material happiness, whatever is due to us, whatever has to come, will come of its own accord. Why make such endeavor for it, he says. There's no use making endeavor, because whatever is meant to come will come. But he says endeavor should be made towards the ultimate goal, the final goal, which is to attain Lord Krishna, which is to attain our permanent destination. So actually it's quite interesting that people who study dreams, they actually find out that our whole experience that we see all at night, you know, this whole long thing and this whole drama that we go through at night, is just actually like a second in the mind. It just happens in a second, and we tend to think of it to be such a long time, such a long duration. The same thing is, the analogy is so nice, in the same way, this whole material experience that we have, it seems so long, right? It seems so complicated and all these things. But from the point of view of the spiritual, it's just a moment, right? We just come in this material world for just a moment. We leave Krishna for, like we, you know, fall asleep for a minute. And we leave Krishna for just a moment, and we go through so many lifetimes, millions and millions of births in this material world. And then finally, when we become frustrated with this experience, we become disenchanted with the whole material world, then we get this desire to wake up. Where is my original home? Where do I belong? Where do I want to go back to? When do we generally wake up from a dream? Right? When is it that we're going through this whole thing, and when is it that generally we snap out of the dream?
Yeah. When you're rested?
Huh?
When you're satisfied?
No. You can keep on. There's no point of.
When
it becomes really miserable, doesn't it? Generally, unless once we're rested, like you're saying, that's also part of it. You're right. So we're satisfied. We're sort of done with it. But generally when it becomes quite miserable, right? Then we wake up suddenly, we scream, and then we wake up. So in the same way, this is the purpose of the suffering in this world, right? Krishna gives us suffering in this world. Through the process of suffering, when we become disgusted with it, and we're in a desperate position, and we're calling out to Krishna, then that becomes a very favorable situation to wake up from the dream, right? Krishna, this is why Krishna gives us suffering. So many people ask, why is there suffering? So, because this becomes an inspiration or an impetus, you could say, to wake up from our dream situation. Actually, this analogy is described as Krishna giving us a direct experience of our situation in this material world, right? It's like a little window. We can sort of, by our experience of waking and dreaming, we can sort of realize our experience of real consciousness, which is our spiritual form, Krishna consciousness, and this being in this material form. Now, when we're in the dream, then is there anything that we can do so one way that we wake up, right, is when it gets difficult, right, suffering, when suffering is there, right? But what's the general way, you could say that the normal way, when we wake up from a dream or a sleep, right? Is there anything that we can do from within the dream that will wake us up? How do we normally, if someone's screaming and shouting, right, and kicking, right, you see someone doing that, then what do you normally do? What is it that you normally do? What does someone normally do? Yeah, he goes and shakes them, you know, kicks them. Come on, man, wake up. Give him a pinch. Or you wake up that person. Someone else comes and wakes it up. So that's the role of the devotee, right? That we're saying the devotee. That someone, like Srila Prabhupada, the great devotees of the Lord, who are already awakened, who are fully realized, they're outside of this dream world. So they can actually see our pitiful condition, that we're crying for nothing. We're crying for things, for false, illusory, temporary things. And because they're awakened, they can actually see that. And they can solve the problem altogether. How do they solve the problem altogether? One way to solve the problem is to try to go in the dream and try to make the situation comfortable enough that you can have a nice dream environment, right? And feel very happy there, you know, provide all the necessities of whatever that person needs in that situation. But another way, they solve it altogether by waking us up, by taking us back to Krishna, right? By taking us, just waking us up altogether. So therefore, this is why Krishna consciousness is called the highest welfare work, because it solves the problem from the root, right? The entire problem of human existence, birth, death, old age and disease, all these difficulties are solved from the very root, from the very basis of that situation. And therefore, it's the spiritual master or the guru who wakes us up from this position. Now, one last thing. So therefore, we've said, right, we've tried to show that therefore anything that we do in this dream life is completely insignificant, right? It's temporary, it's insignificant. So now the question is, but why is it significant? Why is human life still very significant? Why should we care about what we do in the dream?
Only from human form you can wake up.
That's true. Not at all. So there are some special circumstances, right? Animals who get the Lord's mercy, but that's true. But why is our human form of life significant?
The end of this dream and this false state.
Yes. So what can we do in that dream, which is this human birth, that is significant? So someone else said that.
Yeah, I wanted to tell that in human life there is a difference that you can choose what we do in this dream.
Yes. So even though all of our actions are temporary, they're insignificant in this world, there's significance because whatever we do in the dream world leads us out of the dream world, takes us out of the dream world. So action in this world takes us out of this world. Right? So Prabhupada in one tape, he says so nicely, he says, when our desire to attain Krishna is so strong, that he says that in this life, which is a dream, the only thing that we think about is going back to Krishna. So much so that even in our dreams, so in the dream of the dream, we're dreaming of Krishna, right? Then Krishna takes us out of the dream. He takes us out of this material world. So he says, so this is, Krishna is putting us in this situation, in this world, to see how sincere we are. And based on our activities and our sincerity in this life, that inspires the grace of the Lord, and that takes us out of this material world. So that's why it's so significant. Everything that we do is so significant. Because our action in the dream world will take us out of the dream world. Ultimately, it's a grace of the Lord, right? Ultimately, nothing can take us out fully from the material world than if someone outside comes and shakes us. So ultimately, we can never fully become free of this material world until we have the grace of the Lord and His devotees. But what inspires that grace is our action in this world, is our austerities for Krishna. Tapasya. That whatever austerities we perform for Krishna, Krishna appreciates that. And he sees that this person really wants to go out of this world. He wants to attain me by our actions in this world. And then he takes us out of this situation. So that's why Prahlad Maharaji says that therefore austerities and penance should only be performed for satisfying the Lord. One should not perform austerities for any other purpose. All endeavor, all action and desires should be aimed to that end. So I think our time is up. If anyone has any questions or comments.
How should we understand what Prabhupada says in the first line of the purport that this is meant for yogis, jnanis, and Prithu Raj doesn't seem to be either of them. Neither Pandavas or Rudava, who was personally advised by Krishna to go to the forest and things like that. So
yes.
How should we understand that this is not for...
Well, to some degree, the advanced jnani or the advanced yogi is a devotee, is a bhakti yogi. They're sort of non-different, right? Now, Krishna and the Gita, for both of these, he has one verse each where he's telling how the end of both of these is devotion to him. For the jnani, he says, Bahunam janmanamante jnanavan mahaprapadyate vasudeva sarvamiti samahatma sudurlava. That after many births of acquiring knowledge, one comes to the realization that Vasudeva Sarvamiti, that Vasudeva is everything. Right? And for the yogi, what does he say? He says, Yogi nam api sarvesham madgate nantaratmana shraddhavan bhajatiyam sarvi yuktatmo mata. That the highest yogi is my devotee. So in some ways, a devotee is a yogi and he is a jnani. Right? He's a perfect yogi and he's a perfect jnani. So these the Pandavas, and for example, Maharaj Prithu, many times they were performing the austerities that are prescribed to jnanis and yogis. But they were, you could say, they were the best of the jnanis and yogis. They were the topmost jnanis and yogis. And therefore, the aim of all of their austerities was only to please the Lord. So they were following a particular process. But just because they were following the process of the jnanis or yogis doesn't mean that they weren't devotees. Right? There's many paths according to different ages. And in Prithu Maharaj's age, you know, this was the path of attaining the Lord. It was very difficult. They were performing the way, performing kirtan and eating prasad and all these things would be too easy for that age. Because they're doing that anyway. So to show their sincerity, they have to, do something more severe. So they would go to the forest. And then there also, Prabhupada says, they were worshipping Krishna. He said Krishna worship didn't start in Kaliyuga. It started from Satyug. They're still glorifying the name of the Lord. They're still meditating on the name of the Lord. But their process was very severe. And that's why we find that many times these great devotees, they're performing, you know, great intense austerities. Because the jnani, in some ways, he's when he's on the right path, and when he's advanced, then he is becoming a bhakti yogi. The yogi is becoming a bhakti yogi. So there's no like overnight change or distinction between that. They're gradually advancing to come to that point of pure devotion to the Lord. And they're doing it by example, you know, showing people by example. So like, that's also another point. So like the Pandavas, you know, they were associates of Lord Krishna throughout their whole life. So they really had no need to go to the forest when they gave up their kingdom, you know, at the age of giving it up. But they did so to show an example to people in general. That's the best answer.
You mentioned that in the spiritual world there is no time.
There's time, yes.
There is time.
Yes.
Does that mean that everything happens in the same moment?
Yes. Well, that's the thing, right? It's, we, on one hand, we say that it's timeless. right? That there's material world, spiritual world is not controlled by time. But on the other hand, we talk about lila or pastime, right? Now, pastime involves time. You know, Krishna was there with his mother. Now he's in the forest. Then he'll be going back home in the evening. So there's definitely a concept of time. So time is there, but it's time within timelessness, in the sense that time is still moving, but no moment is lost. So in the world of time, we actually cannot conceive of this, how this exactly works. But one way we can understand it is that in this world, so Krishna's pastimes, they go on, right? They keep on, you know, he has newer and newer pastimes. It's not even that, then many devotees, they tend to think, well, it's the same pastimes going in a circle, revolving, right? Like a merry-go-round. But it's not even just that, because it's described in the Chaitanya Charitamrita that everything is newer and newer. There's Krishna is becoming more and more beautiful, Srimati Radharani is becoming more and more beautiful, even though they're unlimitedly beautiful, they're performing newer and newer pastimes. So it's always expanding, it's going on. But one way we can understand it is that the difference in this world is just like we go through a very good experience, right? We have, you know, the time of our life. We go to the Bahamas for 4 days. This is what rich people do, right? They have no time, they're working day and night to earn the money. Then they go to the Bahamas for 4 days. And that's their vacation. And the rest of the year, they talk about those 4 days, right? Because the rest of the year is just miserable. And they spend like tons of money for those 4 days. But the problem is, in this material world, remembering those 4 days is different from actually being there, right? So remembering something is actually different from actually being involved in that place. But in the spiritual sense, when we remember Krishna's pastimes, is actually the same experience as actually being there. Just like we say Krishna's name, that chanting Krishna's name is actually being in contact with Krishna when we do it in a purified way. So in the same way, there's always Krishna's pastimes are always never lost, you could say, in some ways. But he's at the same time performing newer pastimes. So another analogy, one example that we can give, a nice example, is just like you have a video camera, right? A video. So, what is a video? A video is a set of thousands of pictures, right? There's like, they say 10 pictures per second, and they all go very quickly. So, the eye cannot see the change of pictures, so we see that it's continuous, right? So, many times they describe time like this. The time is a collection of millions of moments, right? So, in this material, we're going through this video of life, right? Through all these different moments of life. And as we go, the past is lost, right? Everything behind us is lost forever. Now in the spiritual, one way we can understand is that we go through so many different pastimes, right? Krishna is doing newer and newer pastimes. But that time is not lost, in the sense that those pictures are never lost. So the devotee, if he desires, he can go back into that pastime and serve Krishna again in that pastime. So you're in one pastime at one moment, you could say, but Krishna's pastimes are always going on, and there's always some devotees in some pastime. It's like Prabhupada says that Krishna's pastimes with the Pandavas is always going on in some universe or the other. So, one devotee may be conceiving one pastime at some time, but Krishna's pastimes are going on eternally, and there's always some devotee in that particular pastime serving Krishna in that particular way. But this is all, you know, our feeble attempt to try to conceive of the inconceivable, right? Talking about spiritual time is very difficult.
You class it basically based on the analogy that this life in the material world is a dream. Quote, it's a great charge. And on and on. What guarantee, what justification can you offer us that if we practice Krishna consciousness, that is not simply another dream?
Yes.
Where does it stop? So is it?
Right. That's a good point. The very good point is, at what point does it stop? How do we know it's not a dream within a dream within a dream within a dream, and we just keep on awakening to new dreams? And let's change. Well, the point is, the very definition of a dream is that why we call a dream is that it's temporary. So if you have a permanent dream, in other words, let's say Krishna, you know, the spiritual world is a dream, but it's a permanent dream, then that is reality. You see what I mean? Then that is what reality is. Then you're actually there. The only reason why we call this thing not reality, why we're not impersonalists, but why do we call this mature world an illusion as unreal? Prabhupada, in many places, he says this mature world is unreal. He says that clearly. So it's unreal in the sense that it's temporary. The question, whether this world is a dream because it's temporary. If the material world was all that existed, if this was permanent, then this is all we would have, and we would never even have the thought of trying to attain something higher. But because we know it's going to end, live in the world of temporality, we question, is there a world of permanence? But once we're in the world of permanence, then that dream is our reality. Also the Bhagavan describes, right, that we're always in Maya. That's the other thing, is that no matter how much devotional service we do, we're always going to stay in Maya. Right? We can't get free of Maya, because we have two choices: either to be in Mahamaya, Krishna's material energy, or to be in Yoga Maya, Krishna's spiritual energy. Right? The residents of Vrindavan, in some ways, they see Krishna as their child, which is not the correct understanding. Krishna's God, you know, he's the supreme personality of Godhead, right? Someone could say, but they're in that Yoga Maya permanently. That is, you could say, the permanent reality. So therefore, that is reality. Krishna is actually ultimately a child. He's not ultimately God, because that's the way things are eternally. So that won't ever change. So Mother Yashoda's reality, which is Krishna as a child, is actually even a deeper, even a stronger or a truer reality than the understanding that Krishna is God. Because, you know, the supreme powerful being. Because Mother Yashoda is eternally Krishna's mother, and Krishna is eternally her son. So that never changes. So therefore that is reality. Krishna in reality is a child, and he's Mother Yashoda's child. So, in some ways we're always in a dream, but that dream is permanent. So we're happy in that dream. Okay. Any other comments? Thank you. Hare Krishna. Srimad Bhagavatam ki. Yeah.